Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Catholic Answers Live, Cy Kellett, your host here, and there's an old movie from World War II called A Guy Named Joe, and then there's another movie, I think from the 1950s, called Three Guys Named Mike, and if you combine those two and get Three Guys Named Joe, that describes our first hour. I was the only person on the air last hour who was not named Joe, Joey, or Joseph. It was an all-Joe hour, and Joe Heschmeyer, the lone survivor from that hour, only because we pay him, he has to stay here. Welcome back, Joe. What'd you think of that hour?
I'm happy to be back. I think the other guys would have stayed around. I think the Joey and Joseph, they seemed happy to stick around.
But, yeah.
It'd be nice to get some other callers, too, who aren't named Joe to see if they've got good thoughts, too.
Man, I tell you what, conversations between Christians who don't agree with one another but are Christian towards one another are, I think they're just priceless. I don't think you could put a price on that. That's like those guys, they didn't have to do that. That was a favor to us. I mean,
it was really beautiful that they shared their thoughts on it. I say this all the time, but I'm going to say it again. So often, I think people are afraid to do that because they're afraid it's going to be insulting or something. If somebody tells you why they're not Catholic, you know, you think you're going to hurt our feelings as Catholics. But the reality is, for any well-formed Catholic, that is such a golden opportunity to be able to say, well, here's why I am Catholic.
But for you too.
And also to hopefully, you know, help them understand an issue that may give them some real concern. So often it's like this thing that they're right to be worried about, but it just turns out that isn't quite how it is.
Right. I just made a joke at your expense, and you completely missed it.
Missed it.
Yeah, sorry. That's all right. You can go back and hear it. You can go listen to the tape later.
I'm dreading it. I'm going
to... No, it's not that. It wasn't a good joke. It was just a joke. All right. Let's go back to the phones. By the way, Joe Heschmeyer's podcast is called Shameless Popery. Joe is a shameless papist. He was working so hard with those two callers last hour, we never talked about it. So I will take a little time to let Joe tell us what's on it this hour. But I also feel like we kept callers waiting a long time. So I want to get a couple folks on with you. How about if we go to Spencer, Tennessee to start this hour, where Andrew is listening on the Catholic Answers app. Andrew, why aren't you Catholic?
Well, I actually am Catholic. My buddy is not, but I don't know how I'm going to follow up those two guys. Those guys were awesome.
They were awesome.
They were.
But yeah, they were. Great episode of Shameless Popery too, by the way, Joe.
Thank you very much.
Earlier this morning, and it's great to be on with the legendary Cy Kellett. So
you are just full of compliments, aren't you today? Everybody's going to leave you feeling good, Andrew.
Well, I'm going to do my best to articulate this, okay?
All right.
I got a really good friend. He's been Protestant his entire life. He's even going for a theology degree. And he's come a long way as far as objections to the Catholic Church, to the point where it's down to two objections. That's it. One is the Assumption of Mary, which I feel like in time will resolve on its own, honestly. The other is church infallibility. And his big issue the last time we spoke was the fact that if the church is infallible, how can it flip-flop? So his example was, and I couldn't really find any examples of this, he said after the Reformation, the church teaching or declaration, however he put it, was to burn Baptists at the stake as heretics. And he's very honest, so wherever he got this information, like he feels like it's true, he wouldn't just make up hearing it, right? So I brought up the fact that, was he talking about the Spanish Inquisition? Because I'm fairly certain at that time the Pope spoke out against that, and it was the king in Spain that himself. I'm not sure if that's completely true off the top of my head, but are there any documented in church history after the Reformation where that did occur, where the church ordered Baptists to be burned as heretics at the stake?
I don't remember specifically Baptists, but there certainly were times where heretics were turned over to the civil authorities where they would be burned. And this was one of the issues that Protestants raised against the Catholic Church. And so what is this rooted in? Well, this is rooted in a biblical and theological and pastoral kind of issue. And St. Thomas Aquinas actually grapples with this in the Summa. So in the Summa, in the second part of the second part, question 11, he asks in Article 3, should heretics be tolerated? And there's some argument biblically that they should be, that trying to pluck up all of the weeds in the garden, you end up doing a lot of damage. That's certainly the example we seem to get in Matthew 13. And therefore, we should let them grow together till the harvest. But on the other hand, there is an actual role we have to root out those who are perverting souls and leading people to hell. And that we're not, like, the message is not just to sit idly by or just to ask them to stop or something like this. That rather, St. Paul says to Titus in Titus 3, as for a man who is factious, after admonishing him once or twice, have nothing more to do with him, knowing that such a person is perverted and sinful, he is self-condemned. And so speaking on this in the context of what do you do with heretics, St. Thomas Aquinas says, on the part of the church, however, there's mercy, which looks to the conversion of the wanderer, wherefore she condemns not at once, but after the first and second admonition, as the apostle directs. After that, if he is yet stubborn, the church, no longer hoping for his conversion, looks to the salvation of others by excommunicating him and separating him from the church, and furthermore delivers him to the secular tribunal to be exterminated thereby from the world by death. Now, we would no longer do that second part. That second part is closely tied with the role of the state. So everything else, we would continue to say, yes, you should admonish people wandering from the faith, and if they repeatedly resist, if they are not open to receiving correction, then you need to cut them off from the Christian community so they don't lead others astray. Just as if somebody was a danger to kids, you'd keep them away from kids. If somebody's a danger to souls, you keep them away from the souls of others. You don't need to allow someone out of a misguided sense of liberty to share ideas that are polluting and corrupting. And so that's why we have things like excommunication. This is rooted very much in a biblical depiction of how you respond to this. So what's changed? Well, what's changed is turning them over to the state where the state will execute them. And that is in no small part because of a radically different conception of the state that we have today. States at the time St. Thomas Aquinas and others are writing, derived their authority and knew they derived their authority from God. And so they viewed heresy not simply as an offense to God, but actually as an undermining of the authority of the state, as a kind of treason. Because if you derive your authority from God and someone's coming along and saying, actually, your version of God is completely wrong, then that undermines not only the church, but also the state as well. So there was this particular vision of the state. Now, the modern state doesn't generally share that. The modern state has this idea that we're a government of the people, by the people, for the people. And they don't recognize, at least not explicitly, that actually the authority of America and of all countries comes from the God of the Bible. And that without that God of the Bible, you don't have any legitimate authority for the state at all. And so because we have this conception now of a secular state, the idea of punishing a heretic with secular authority strikes most people as obviously wrong. I'm leaving aside the question of if the state did punish, what would the appropriate punishment be? Just to say the state now doesn't get into that business, but that is largely a shift in the role of the state. The church continues to excommunicate heretics to protect them for the reasons that St. Thomas Aquinas laid out.
Well, you tied it up nicely there at the end. I appreciate that. So you're saying back then the state handled the execution if they continued in their heretical ways. It wasn't
the church. Yeah, because they were viewed as a threat to the social order. About it this way.
All right, well,
when Protestantism does arrive on the scene, one of the first consequences of it is the bloodiest war Europe had ever seen. And so it's actually true that when they were worried that introducing a bunch of different ideas that are heretical might lead to a bunch of violence and then the undermining of the authority of the state, all of those things did happen.
I tell you what, Andrew, I if I can, I'm going to put you back on hold and you can talk with Darren. Maybe we could give you, we have a course that Chris Check taught on the Inquisition. That might be of interest to you. Anything else that we can, you can think of that's ours that we should give Andrew, Joe?
Trying to remember the, we've got something on the Crusades.
We've got the off topic. No, we got the Glory of the Crusades. We'll give him that.
Yeah,
we'll
Glory of the Crusades. That seems kind of relevant for it. It's kind of adjacent to this question of the collaboration and relationship between church and state.
Hang on, we'll give it to you. And if there's anything else that we can be any other way we can be helpful to your friend, just call back and we'll continue the conversation. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Why aren't you Catholic? Is our question. And you know what? Every single line full with somebody who wants to answer that question for us. Right back with more after this.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more in step with the liturgical rhythm of the church on the web at Magnificat.com.
Join us throughout the month of June in devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, plus coverage of the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage, the Solemnity of Corpus Christi, and the ordination anniversaries of EWTN campus clergy. And of course, Catholic Radio's premier shows, featuring EWTN News Nightly, The Journey Home, and more. EWTN Radio, your source of truth that allows Catholics to grow in their faith and recognize the true mission of the Catholic Church.
Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. As I said, lots of people on the phone, but I got to let Joe at least tell us a little bit about what's going on at Shameless Popery, a wildly popular podcast and YouTube channel. Joe, what's going on at Shameless Popery, a wildly popular podcast and YouTube channel?
I've got two things. One, related to the growing popularity of the channel, which I'm very honored by, we are closing in on 100,000 subscribers. And so we're trying to figure out what's a good way to kind of celebrate that. But we're at 99,000 and some change. So if you haven't subscribed, if this is a channel that you like, let's try to hit 100,000 soon.
Do it.
And
come on, people. What?
Do yeah. I'm just, and then two, in terms
I'm being
of
your
actual
hype
content,
man, Joe. Joe's like, what? Like there's some content to what I'm saying. I'm just being a hype man. Come on, people, do it. Put your hands together. All right, go ahead, Joe.
Okay. In terms of content, so Pope Leo talked about just war theory being outdated and needing to go beyond that in the context of modern warfare in his new encyclical.
Oh,
and
yeah.
A lot of people called him out, accusing him of contradicting Catholic teaching and all of this. And so I explored in this week's episode that this is actually a pretty standard view on all sides of the spectrum, that you find people like Benedict XVI who talks about this. You find people like Cardinal Ottaviani, who is a beloved figure within traditional Catholicism, who make the argument that it's not clear how there can be a just offensive war in the modern age with the nature of weaponry, that the risk to the human population seems so high that it's not clear what would justify starting a new war. So I think it's good context for people who have been taught that, oh, Leo's just like embracing pacifism or contradicting church teaching. It's like, no, the standards, it's just not clear how anyone can meet those standards anymore because the weapons have changed, because the means of warfare have changed. And so we might need a new kind of way of thinking about these topics if we're going to have anything helpful to say. And then additionally, Leo is very explicitly not arguing for pacifism in the document, which is good to know. Like, he believes in legitimate self-defense in a country. And so even when you hear him talk about war in context, we should understand he is talking specifically about waging war, about offensive war, not about, you know, legitimate self-defense.
Check it out. Shameless Popery. You can find it wherever you get your good podcasts, and you can find Joe's YouTube channel, well, on YouTube. All right, let's go down to Plaquemine Parish. I think it's called Plaquemine Parish. I think they call them parishes down there in Louisiana.
They do.
Chad,
I don't know about the Plaquemine part, but you're right about the parish part.
How did I do, Chad? Is it Plaquemine Parish?
No, it's Plaquemines in the town. It's not Plaquemines Parish. It's right outside of Baton Rouge.
All right, what's the parish?
It is a Plaquemines Parish, but Iberville Parish.
That's a different thing. Okay. All right. Well, it was nice talking to you. Call again sometime, Chad. Thanks. Bye. Oh, no, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Go ahead. You got Joe.
Well, okay, so my middle name is Joseph, so does that count for the Joseph?
Oh, that does count.
Yes, we're being overloaded by Joseph. Not overloaded. We're being blessed by lots of Josephs today. That's what I should have said. Yeah.
Right. Well, my question is this. I don't want to take too much time because there's other people on hold. But, Joe, I've been hearing you talk about, first of all, I'm a Catholic revert. So I was in the Protestant world for many years. And I have this thought about worship that I've been hearing you talk about worship as sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And I know as a Catholic, we see that as that's the Mass. That's the sacrifice of the Mass, representing Jesus' sacrifice on the cross, a representation of it. And when we partake of that worship, then that's worship. That's worshiping. That's the ultimate sacrifice. But then I know the other side of the thought of this, and I wanted to ask you about this, is that in the Protestant world, I would have said this, and I know that many of my friends do. They say, well, we do worship because we do offer sacrifice. It's the sacrifice of praise, which is like in Hebrews 13:15 says, through him, then, Jesus, let us continually offer God a sacrifice of praise, that is, the fruit of lips that confess his name. So in a Protestant worship service, worship is the fruit of your mouth, is singing, preaching, praying, like spontaneous prayer, that sort of thing. So they view that as a sacrifice of praise, so, well, that would be worship. So I want to know your take on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we would largely just agree that the argument shouldn't be there's no sense in which Protestants worship God. That would be false. Because anytime you treat God as God, in a certain sense, you are making an act of worship. So I guess we really want to say two things. Number one, worship is treating God in a uniquely divine way. It comes from worthyship. You're giving God his worth. And as St. Augustine points out in Book 10 of City of God, a lot of the things that we do towards God are things that we can also do towards other people. So we honor God, but we honor other people as well. We're even told to. We're told to honor the emperor, but we're not told to worship the emperor. So worship can have honor connected to it, but it's not reducible to honor. Same with prayer. You heard, I think, the call in the last hour where I was talking to Pastor Joseph, that biblically prayer and worship are actually distinguished. You're to pray always. So prayer was everywhere and it's all the time. Whereas for the Jews at the time of Jesus, worship was uniquely in the temple. And so in John chapter 4, verse 20, and then the Samaritan woman asked Jesus about it. She points this out. She says that, you know, you believe that worship is to be done in Jerusalem, and she's referring to the temple. Whereas the Samaritans believe it's to be done on Mount Gerizim. That they didn't think that was the only place you could pray. They knew you could pray anywhere. But there was this thing that was distinct from prayer called worship. So Augustine talks about what is unique about worship that is different than all these other things that can be done, like honor, like prayer, etc. And what's unique is sacrifice. So it's not that we don't want to say worship is only sacrifice, but this is the unique and kind of defining feature of it. And as Everett Ferguson points out, it is the language of worship in the early church. Now, he is a Church of Christ scholar, but his book, The Early Church at Work and Worship, it says that sacrifice was the universal language of worship in the ancient world. That's true of the early Christians, and it's true of the Jews and the pagans at this time. That when you said worship, that has sacrificial connotations. So there are ways of worshiping God, simply approaching God as God, which we wouldn't often think about as sacrifice, but which can still be worship. But the heart of worship is sacrifice. And so when we offer sacrifice of praise, when we are giving of ourselves, when we're doing these things for God as God, we can direct those things in such a way that they are sacrificial actions. All of that is true. But the point I think is worth stressing is a lot of what gets talked about as worship within Protestantism is at best kind of adjacent to worship. So, for example, if your idea of a worship service is we read scripture and then we talk about it, you know, we have a sermon and the sermon is like the vast bulk of the liturgy on Sunday, that looks like the synagogue in Jesus's day. Like in Luke 4, Jesus goes in the synagogue, he reads scripture, he preaches on it. That looks like a lot of particularly evangelical so-called worship services. But the problem is, even though the synagogue is good, it is not a place of prayer and it's not a place of worship. How do we know that? One, they're never described as a place of prayer or worship. Worship was connected to the temple. And prayer, the only time prayer gets mentioned with the synagogue at all, anywhere in the Bible, is in Matthew 6 when Jesus says not to pray in the synagogues as the hypocrites do. But even for the hypocrites, they don't go to the synagogue to pray because they think it's a special place of prayer. Jesus talks about them going to the synagogues and street corners, meaning they're just trying to go out in public so people can watch them pray because they're hypocrites. So this was not a place of prayer. It's not a place of worship. So if your idea of what worship is a thing that Jesus wouldn't have considered worship, that's a red flag. So a lot of what Protestants today think of as worship in many cases, I don't want to speak with a broad brush, isn't worship at all, really. But meanwhile, they're doing other things like praising God that would be worship, but it's often in these places that maybe they're not even at church, but they're just giving God these moments of praise, or they're helping someone else out for God's sake. And those are real moments of worship, even if they're not talked about in that way. I hope that makes sense. I'm not trying to say they don't worship. I'm saying that they often don't have a good understanding of what worship is as distinct from prayer, because you hear a lot this claim that prayer is a species of worship, or that prayer and worship are the same thing. And it's simply not true biblically. Then finally, the heart of true Christian prayer collectively, you know, we can offer up in our own bodies the sacrifices in our body. This is Romans 12:1. That's our spiritual worship. When you are inconvenienced for the sake of somebody else and you offer it up, that is an act of worship. Absolutely. But collectively, when we come together to worship, this is the Eucharistic sacrifice. That is the highest expression of Christian worship, and was understood that way from the first century. Like the Didache, when it talks about the Eucharist, it talks about it as a sacrifice, and as a sacrifice that was prefigured in Malachi 1, where God said that the Jewish priests were corrupting the table of the Lord, but that the Gentiles would come and offer a true sacrifice at the Lord's table. Well, when St. Paul describes the Eucharist taking place at the Lord's table, this looks like a fulfillment of that, that the Eucharist is a true sacrifice. And for this reason, it is the very heart of how we pray and worship together as the church.
Okay, Chad?
Yes, that's a great response, Joe. I really appreciate that. It was very well said, and I agree with it. I agree with everything you said. And I think Protestants, they do worship it. I did whenever I was a Protestant, but it's just now that I see the fullness of the faith, it's sort of incomplete in a way. And I know that now whenever I participate in the Eucharistic sacrifice and Mass, and I partake of the Eucharist, there's nothing like it. There's no worship that compares to that now that I know it. And when I know what's happening at that altar and what I'm partaking of, it changes me, and it changes me into more Christ-like person. And there's nothing like it. And
praise God.
So I appreciate your answer, Joe.
Chad, that's wonderful.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, Chad, I talk about some of these themes in my book, The Eucharist is Really Jesus. I don't know if you have that book or not, but I thought it might be nice to send it if you want to stick around on the line.
Let's send him two books. Let's send him The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, too, because I already typed that in. So
I like it. All right.
Two books. Perfect. Because I typed it in early that I wanted you to get that book, Chad. Thank you for the call. We got time to take another call before we have to take a break. Let's go to Orange, California, right up the road from us. Daniel, watching on YouTube. Daniel, why aren't you Catholic?
Hi. I wanted to see if I could get some feedback, like an opinion on the position that I'm currently taking. Because
okay.
The reason why I'm not Catholic or Protestant or any other type of Christian is because it seems to me like I'm being pulled in different directions It seems like I'm being asked to join the Catholic Church or Protestant Church or Jehovah's Witness, and I'm not being asked to join God. So I think it makes more sense to me. It's easier on my conscience to just remain neutral and not involve myself in like the divisiveness. And I wanted to
What does that look like in terms of your own worship?
Well, I just read the Bible and I pray privately, or I talk to my family or friends or anybody that I meet on the street. I talk to them about what I've learned, stuff like that.
So I think one of the dangers with the sort of approach of neutrality, I get what you're wanting to do of, well, you know what? Let's talk about it after this break. Is that okay?
Can you hang on?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, because Joe heard the music and he knows what that means. There's no choice once that music starts playing. We got to go to the break. Why aren't you Catholic is our question today. Daniel in Orange County, avoiding all the controversies. We'll see if that's a good strategy when we come back with Joe on Catholic Answers Live.
What was the church like in its infancy? In a word, Catholic. And Joe Heschmeyer has the receipts. In his best-selling book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church, he gives you the details from the historical records of the first two centuries of Christianity. Right now, get a copy for just $10, plus free shipping if you live in the continental United States. Get more information and order The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at theearlychurchwascatholic.com.
What is the Catholic Church? Everyone seems to have an opinion, but the church never quite fits into the boxes people make for it. In The Faith Unboxed, author Andrew Petiprin looks at some of the most common boxes people put the Catholic Church in and explains why they don't fit. In doing so, he brings us closer to what the church really is, the institution founded by Christ. Order The Faith Unboxed today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
You've heard the same tired anti-Catholic arguments again and again, and you know they don't hold up. But explaining why isn't always easy. In The Protestant Fallacies, Parker Manning unpacks the most common objections to Catholicism, exposes their flaws, and makes the Catholic response clear, practical, and even fun. Understand your faith and talk about it with confidence. Get your copy of The Protestant Fallacies today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
From the dawn of creation, angels have stood in the presence of God as messengers, warriors, and guardians. Some seek our fall, some intercede for our salvation, and one is assigned to protect you. In the new book, Angelic Answers, Father Mike Driscoll uncovers the truth about angels and their unseen battles. So mysterious to us, and yet so close. Get Angelic Answers today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
What event brought you closer to your spouse or family? Tell us about it on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie. And now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, Joe Heschmeyer. Our guest this hour and our topic, why aren't you Catholic? And lots of great conversations. I got to say, just lots of great conversations today. On the line now is Daniel in Orange, California. And Joe, Daniel said he wanted some feedback on whether his strategy was a good one.
Yeah. So his strategy is, because Catholics and Orthodox and Protestants are divided, to not kind of sign up for any of the teams and pray on his own or with his family, and then talk to people in a more informal way about Jesus. Is that a good way of summarizing your thought?
Yes.
So I think the first danger to that is that we're warned against that in Hebrews 10. Beginning in verse 23, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. The KJV has for that part, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, but exhorting one another. And so we are called to come together as the body of Christ. And this is not only for our own good, but is also for the good of other people, so we can exhort and encourage them. If you've ever been in a church where, you know, maybe it's a very big church that was once really vibrant and not many people go to Mass there anymore or go to whatever church service there anymore and has this kind of empty, cavernous feeling, that can be really spiritually depressing. It can be very desolate as an experience. Whereas if you go to a church where it's bursting at the seams and people are praying and they're worshiping and they're putting their whole hearts in it, that's not just good for them. That's good for everyone around them. And it's so much easier in that context to pray. I mean, I can say in my own experience, I've been spiritually transformed by good models of prayer. And so we have these calls to come together, to assemble together, so the flock can be with the shepherd, so that the kingdom can be with the king, so the body can be with the head. In this way that is good for us in our relationship with God, but also good for us in our relationship with other people on that journey, on that way. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, it's just that in my personal experience, it's kind of more complicated because even my friends, like they belong to, some of them are Catholic, some of them are Protestant. And mm-hmm. in my family, it's the same case. So when I go online to hear different, I guess, interpretations of the Bible or of Christianity, it sounds like they're telling me if I don't belong to a specific brand of Christianity that I'll be lost, or if I join that group or faction, whatever, then that means the people who aren't joining with me, like my loved ones, they're going to be lost. So I want to like avoid all that. And to me, it seems like it's easier to just stay out of that for my own personal conscience.
I get what you mean. I would say this. First, Jesus wants us all to be united. I mean, he prays for us to be united, right? And so I think you have this same desire to be united, but you're trying to achieve it in a different way. Without putting words in your mouth, it seems almost like you're trying to achieve it by just avoiding the conflicts. But the conflicts are going to be there. People are going to read the Bible in opposite ways, and just deciding that you're not going to take a side or that you're not going to talk about it doesn't actually resolve the conflict. It just kind of avoids it. And when you avoid conflicts, they just tend to fester and build up. And we're called to something more. We're called to actually be one heart and one mind, to be truly united in Jesus. And so one of the ways Jesus gives us to achieve that goal is the church. So to St. Timothy in 1 Timothy 3, he tells him, I hope to come to you soon, but I'm writing these instructions to you so that if I'm delayed, you may know how one ought to behave in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the bulwark of the truth. So it does seem important to be connected with the church because the church is the pillar and bulwark of the truth. And look, if the church was simply man-made, if the church was just a group of people saying, here's my best read of the Bible, then it would be arrogant to call your best read of the Bible the pillar and bulwark of the truth. And so there's no Protestant denomination that can really claim to be the household of God, the pillar and the bulwark of the truth. But that's what the church is. And so the church can't be this thing of merely human origin. Rather, Jesus says in Matthew 16, I will build my church. And now you have people say, oh, that's like a spiritual idea of just the Christians wherever they are. No, because Timothy can't look to that because that doesn't exist. It needs to be an actual visible thing. And Jesus compares it to a city on a hill. And so it's visible, like a city on a hill. And it's organized like a city. And even more than that, in Matthew 13, Jesus compares it to a mustard seed, the smallest, that grows into a mustard tree, the largest of all the plants of the garden. So we're looking for a visible church that can trace its lineage back to Jesus, And there's only one, and it's the largest one around, and it's visible and structured. And I think when you put all that biblical evidence together and say, where do I find the church that Jesus is talking about here? Where do we find the church St. Paul is referring to? If you don't come in with a bunch of preconceived notions about what you think the word church means, and you just come in saying, where does the biblical evidence lead? It seems to me it only leads one place. There's only one church that is that large and that ancient and everything else. And that's the church that we're all meant to be part of.
Yeah. It's because I guess it, I understand what you're telling me, but it doesn't really give me a solution because I'm still, you're saying that I'm avoiding the conflict, but at the same time, it's a conflict that can never be resolved. And I understand that. I can foresee that it's never going to be resolved.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense in which that is just what Jesus has called you to. And now he says that, by the way. He says in Matthew 10, verse 34, do not think that I've come to bring peace on earth. I've not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I've come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. So that is what Jesus actually said. Like, the call to follow the gospel is a call to not just sit back and say, I'm not going to take a side. And it is going to be the kind of thing that might alienate people, even within your own family, because they think that you're judging them or they think you're making a mistake or any of these other things. And so you're absolutely right. That conflict is there. As long as the world remains divided because of the effects of sin, then choosing to follow Christ fully is going to put you at odds with people who aren't following Christ, but it's also going to put you at odds with people who are trying to follow Christ in a way that he didn't call them to follow him. And so it's going to put you on that route where they say, well, I'm also trying to follow Christ, and that's true. But the question then becomes, how does he want us to follow him? And he gives us some objective criteria. Like, he tells us what to look for in the church. He's the one who builds the church. So when we say, well, we're going to follow him in this church we're creating, that's not what we're told to do. Those aren't the instructions. And so we don't want to put anything, even family, above following Jesus. This is what it means to say he doesn't come to bring peace, but the sword. I know that's hard to hear.
I'll tell you what, Daniel, if you'd like, I have to go to the break right now. I am very grateful for the call. If you would like one of our books, I think, ask Darren, tell him the one you want. I can send you a book we have called Why We're Catholic by our colleague Trent Horn, or I can send you Joe's book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Either book I think would be helpful to you. You decide on the one that you think would be helpful to you and let Darren know. We've got to take a quick break, right back with more Why Aren't You Catholic on Catholic Answers Live.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He captivates viewers with thought-provoking political and cultural reporting that resonates with Catholics and people of faith.
The newly appointed bishop in the Philippines is making headlines calling for the church to reconsider its teaching on contraception. How does a bishop with that idea get appointed?
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo, tomorrow night, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Answers Live. How long do you have to send a thank you note to somebody, Joe? How long do you get? Well, like, what's the polite thing? Joe and I were just talking about we stayed with very nice people in Germany, and I have not sent them a thank you note yet. So I was thinking, what does it count if I just say it on the air? Does that get me? Does that get me any credit? I mean, I don't know if they're listening, but is that gonna be, or do
I suspect both of our wives are just like shaking their heads, like this is not how it goes, guys. No. This
like how long do you have till it's rude that you haven't sent a note? And I don't know how long it takes a letter to get to Germany, but I don't think that counts. They'll go by postmark. I think that's how manners work. They go by postmark.
Yeah, the euro is postmark.
But you have no idea how long I have?
That was a currency joke. Never mind. Because they used to have the mark, and postmark, they have the euro.
Oh, my gosh. That was actually a good joke, and I completely missed it. it's post-Reichsmark. That was a Deutschmark. They had the Deutschmark.
Yes. Post both, but we don't talk about one of those anymore.
We don't talk about the Reichsmark. We don't mention that. But there was one in between the two of them. No, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah.
I got to send a thank you note. All right, let me just tell you this. If you live in Germany and I recently stayed in your house, consider this your thank you note.
Thank you, Dan and Patricia.
I didn't want to say their names on the air, but okay, I can say thank
you. I'm not saying last names.
Dan and Patricia. Yeah, in Stuttgart. You're not getting a note. This is it. You were so great to us, but I don't. But no, I got to do a thank you note, Joe. I think I'm late.
I will say I sent a postcard to my wife early on in the trip, and it arrived the same day I did. So that was about a week and a half, I would say.
When I was in Europe, I wrote a note to my wife, and then I just handed it to her.
Ah, see, that would have saved me.
She was there.
Some euros
with me. Get it? Okay, let's go to. I feel bad. I don't know how. Somebody online, tell me, how long do you have until it's rude that you haven't sent a thank you note? I just haven't gotten my act together. That's all. And it's not likely that my act is going to get together. Let's go to Dust.
I was thinking,
but it doesn't count if you just say it on the air, right? You got to send the thank you note. Like, they treated us so well, Joe.
They
took such
well.
Good care of us, Dan and Patricia.
Even
and their lovely
gift
family.
Baskets, like a welcome bag, is crazy.
They also had the coolest dog in the world. They had the single greatest dog that's ever lived. So I feel like I do owe them a thank you note. All right, Dustin in the San Francisco Bay Area. I don't know where that is. I can tell you this. It's expensive wherever he is. If you write San Francisco as your any part of your address, it's expensive. Welcome, Dustin.
That's right. Very expensive. Thank you so much. But you guys are in Orange, California, so it's pretty expensive down there as well, right?
Oh, we're south of Orange. But you're right. California is expensive. But we're down in San Diego.
I would say the best time to send a thank you letter, kind of like me becoming Catholic, is
now.
10 years or immediately, right?
Yeah, I know.
10 years ago, but following that.
Absent my having been able to take care of this so far, is it so late now that I just have to count them off and avoid them at parties? I just have to, like, what? Where am I now, Dustin?
It'll be a nice surprise. Go ahead and get it sent.
It'll
be a nice surprise.
All right, thank you. All right, why aren't you Catholic, Dustin? Come on, give it to us. Why aren't you Catholic?
Well, I'm on my way. I just enrolled in OCIA, so I'm very excited for that. But I'm 46 years old, so I'm 46 years of not being Catholic. And there's been several reasons. I grew up in a non-religious household. My mom, I was baptized in the Episcopalian Church. My paternal grandmother was very faithful to her church and volunteered in the church community, and she was a great model for me. But she was the only person in my family that was religious. I did get married in the Catholic Church to a cradle Catholic, but we're not good Catholics. We don't go to Mass. But we did, you know, put our kids through First Communion classes, and they've gotten the First Communion, but we haven't led a good example, and I've been filling the call to be a better father figure for my children, and knowing that faith is part of it. And I've had a tough year this last year, and that's really caused me to start reading the Bible and getting into it. And in my studies, I do believe that Catholicism is the answer. or the right church or the original church and everything you guys say. I believe in that. But I think what's turned me off from the church for so long is just, you know, the scandals, the rumors you hear about, like the Inquisition and just how Catholics have treated people over the years, and kids who go to Catholic school and received extreme punishment, you know, in school, and you know, the priest abuse scandals. Those things have really turned me off. And then also, one thing that I'm still kind of hesitant about is the approach with the LGBTQ community and their stance on contraception. I think one time we did go to Mass and the sermon was on contraception, and it was like when we were in the early stages of our family planning, and it really turned off because we did use contraception, so until we were ready to have children. So I don't know how you could be against abortion but also against contraception. So it's something that I'm grappling with right now.
Wonderful. These are great questions. So I guess, where do you want to begin? Let's take them kind of one at a time.
There's one more thing too, not to complicate.
Oh, okay.
Matters,
please. Go
another
ahead.
Another friend who's very faithful person is a member of the Seventh-day Adventists, and he's the one who's always telling me about Jesus. And and I, when he found out I was leaning towards Catholicism, he sent me something recently that compared America and the papacy to the beast in Revelation in the book of Daniel. And that was like pretty concerning. But I'm not buying too much into that.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, let's start there, 'cause that's the easiest one to sort of answer. The Whore of Babylon and the beast in Revelation 17 are identified with the Roman Empire, and some interpretations as Jerusalem as well. And one of the reasons is because the beast has 7 heads and 10 horns. And we're told explicitly in Revelation 17, verse 9, this calls for a mind with wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 hills on which the woman is seated. So the woman is seated on 7 hills. So it is a governing authority that's ruling an empire on 7 hills. That looks like the Roman Empire. That ironically does not look like the Catholic Church, because even though the Catholic Church is in the modern city of Rome, it is not on the historic 7 hills. It is outside of that on Vatican Hill, which is why we refer to the Vatican. So if the inspired author had meant to refer to the Vatican and instead misplaced it as on the 7 hills, we know what the 7 hills of Rome are. Vaticanus is not one of them. The reason the Vatican is where the heart of the Church of Rome is precisely because that's where the Christians were martyred. St. Peter was killed where Vatican Hill is, and the reason he was killed there is that they did the executions outside the city, just as Jesus isn't killed inside Jerusalem, he's killed outside the city. So all that's to say, now that might seem like a superficial detail, but you're told how to identify the Whore of Babylon, and then the number 666 is numerically the Hebrew for Nero, adds up to 666, because all of the letters in Hebrew have a numeric value. So all that's to say, we have what looks like a pretty clear indication that while this is Rome, this is the Empire of Rome, not the Church in Rome. And it's only by conflating the Roman Empire and the Catholic Church and the Pope and the Caesar and all of these, and muddling them all together, and then somehow working America into the mix, that you come away with that bad of a misreading of Revelation 17, rather than reading what it's talking about in its own context. A good question to ask would be, when did it become the Whore of Babylon? Because you said your friend is a Seventh-day Adventist, and Seventh-day Adventism, the co-founder of that is a false prophetess by the name of Ellen White. And she claimed that the Catholic Church in the 4th century moved the Christian day of worship from Saturday to Sunday. But there is a huge amount of evidence that none of that is true, that Christians were worshiping in the 100s and before on Sunday. And we're quite open about this and talked about it. Ignatius talks about it in 107. Justin Martyr talks about it in the mid-100s. We know for a fact the day of the Lord, or the Lord's Day, referred to Sunday, and we find it being referred to within Scripture itself. Revelation 1 John mentions being in prayer on the Lord's Day. And so this isn't something that happens in the 300s. The Christians, seemingly almost immediately after the resurrection, start to worship on Sunday rather than Saturday. And so critical to the Seventh-day Adventist claim about why the church was the whore of Babylon and all of this was this entirely fictional history about the church being responsible for changing the day of worship to Sunday. And all of this was allegedly to try to appease pagans because pagans worshiped on Sunday. But the thing is, Sunday wasn't a major pagan day of worship. So the whole theory just is built on completely flimsy and non-existent historical evidence. So don't let your mind be troubled in the slightest about those kind of Adventist claims. They're extremely historically illiterate. Now, as for the other parts, when it comes to historical injustices, it's true that some of them are inflated, but there often is at least a kernel of truth where real bad things were done in the name of the church, and real bad things were done by Christians. And that is a cause for sadness. That is something we should lament and not something we should try to, you know, defend or minimize or downplay and just say, that's really bad. Like if a Catholic mistreats you individually or collectively, I'm really sorry that that happens. And unfortunately, some element of that is going to continue happening until Christ returns, because he creates a church that is a haven for sinners who need salvation. And sinners who need salvation often still act like sinners and do stupid things. And so there will be some dimension where even though the teachings of the church are perfect, the lived lives of the church, you know, the people in the church, are often very far from perfect. We don't practice what we preach sometimes. We don't live up to the call of the gospel. But I will say this. This might be incendiary, but hopefully not too much. In other religious contexts, you can have religious fanatics who the problem is they believe their holy book too much. They believe their religion too much, and it makes them violent and extreme and all these other things. But with Christianity, almost invariably, the issue is that they just didn't believe it enough. They didn't live it enough. They weren't as Christ-like as they should have been. Like, you go down the list and think about almost any injustice, almost any, you know, act of barbarism and violence and everything else. And then ask yourself, if they'd behaved more like Jesus, would this situation have been better or worse? And you get a pretty clear answer. It would be better. But on the other hand, if you say, like, if they'd behaved more like Muhammad in this conflict, would the situation have been better or worse? I don't think you're going to get the same answer every time. So to the extent that we fail, it's largely because we don't live out being Catholic enough, which is not an argument against Catholicism. It is an argument against our own lukewarmness and inadequacy sometimes. And then finally, you know, how should we live now in the face of people with, you know, different gender identities and everything else? We should speak the truth in love, as St. Paul says, that we have a message that can be hard to receive, and we need to proclaim it. We need to do so boldly, but we should also do so lovingly. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. I have people in my family who are homosexual, and I suspect it might even affect other people that are, you know, children that you can just tell they're a bit different. So,
sure.
And I don't think it's... I'm of the belief that you are born that way and that it's not a choice of a lifestyle that you choose. So,
I mean, so everyone, regardless of whether it's biology or upbringing or anything else, I mean, that question to some extent doesn't matter, because all of us find ourselves drawn to things that are good for us, and all of us find ourselves drawn to things that are bad for us. And a lot of the life of just being a human being, but specifically the Christian life, is learning which desires to say yes to and which desires to say no to. Because we have things that we want that are good for us, and we have things we want that aren't good for us. And so we don't have to demonize people because they want bad things sometimes, because that's all of us. The question becomes, how do we identify which things are good and bad, and how do we respond to it, and how do we approach God with his mercy when we fall short of the things we know we ought to do?
Dustin, you can hear the music. I feel terrible because, Joe, this is one of those days when we actually left a lot of people on the line, but that's because there were so many wonderful calls. I hope people will call back, and we'll do our very best to get you on the air. I'm sorry we kept you waiting, and weren't able to get to you. Dustin, if you would like a book, Joe, name a book. What book should we give Dustin?
Oh, how about Why We're Catholic?
All right, we'll send him Why We're Catholic. If you want it, Dustin, just give us an address. We'll send it up there to the San Francisco Bay Area, because we know you're spending all your money on rent, so we better send you a free book. Joe Heschmeyer, go work on your thank you notes. I got to go write a thank you note.
Just add my name.
Oh, Joe and I say thank you. Okay, I'll do that. See you tomorrow, God willing, right here. Catholic Answers Live.